Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and we shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. The purpose of Wiki Politiki is to bring left and right front and center to face the music and dance together, to address problems instead of defending positions. The current COVID-19 crisis has made our healthcare system front burner news. On one hand, there are stories of dedicated and skilled professionals who put their own well-being on the line as being the front line in fighting the COVID infection. And on the other hand, we have those physicians who've been alarmed at the ineffectiveness of the protocols. They've spoken out and they've been shut down. Not only that, but helpful non-drug remedies have been deplatformed by social media at the behest of the World Health Organization, and any information not consistent with the official CDC COVID-19 story has been blatantly censored. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. As a country, we pay more per capita for medical care than any other nation in the world, and all that money buys us health care that ranks 27th in the world, down from 6th 30 years ago. What's wrong with this picture? Perhaps it's a medical system that's about money, money, uber alles, where primary care physicians are little more than plantation slaves paralyzed by university college debt. Instead of noble, independent practitioners, they've largely become employees of managed care conglomerates where executives make millions in salary. Our guest this week is Eric Goldman. He has been serving healthcare professionals who want to practice more holistically for 20 years. He's the founding editor of Holistic Primary Care News for Health and Healing, a medical publication serving 60,000 professionals with news and education about non-pharma alternatives for preventing and treating common chronic conditions. He's also co-producer of Heal by Practice, Transforming Patient Care, a series of conferences that have explored practice models to support holistic medicine, and the Practitioner Channel Forum, an annual executive retreat focused on the opportunities and challenges in the practitioner segment of the natural products industry. Eric has been a medical journalist since 1985 after graduating from the State University of New York in Binghamton with a BS in biology and philosophy. And prior, he was the New York Bureau Chief for International Medical News Group, one of the country's leading medical trade publishers. While there, he covered a range of medical specialties as well as socioeconomic issues in healthcare. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much, Steve, and hello, everybody out there in digital radio land. It's great to be with you. Greetings from Lower Manhattan.
And we emphasis on lower these days. I want to talk about, I'm very familiar with New York. I grew up there. Holistic Primary Care News for Health and Healing. I'd like to get some background. What is the publication about and who's your audience?
Sure thing. So Holistic Primary Care is, we originally founded it to educate primary care doctors and other medical professionals about non-pharma options for preventing and treating common chronic conditions. And over time, that's grown. You know, our audience, especially online, includes a lot of people who are not physicians. I mean, it is scientifically grounded, but it's not like a medical journal in the sense of like, it, you know, a lot of technical, you could call it jargon. You know, we write in, you know, more of a feature style. So it's accessible to anybody who's serious about health, wants to understand what the non-pharma options are, and wants to get more of a holistic perspective on how to maintain and cultivate health. And yeah, we started it back in 2000. It's actually an idea that I had in like 1985 or 1986 when I first got out of college, and I was working as a medical journalist doing conventional stuff. I was actually working for a publication called Dermatology News, and I was covering dermatology, and I was going around to, you know, all these medical meetings, and
you clearly had skin in the game.
I had skin in the game, yeah, and you know, and I was young and naive, and you know, the company that I was working for was producing a lot of other specialty newspapers, and you know, I quickly realized that there was nothing about health in what we were covering, and I was kind of shocked and surprised by that, and it took a while to understand how the, you know, the pharmaceutical industry influences medical education and continuing medical education, and how they shape the way doctors think about things. But, you know, I had an idea, but it was, yeah, early, mid-80s for, you know, gee, someone should do a magazine like this, you know, like that I was working for, but focused on all the holistic stuff, because for myself and most of my friends, that's what we were interested in. And I didn't understand why there wasn't one, you know, and it was an idea that just kept coming and coming over the years on and off. And I never thought that it would be, you know, myself or, you know, it would be something I would do. But I met my partner, Meg Sinclair, and she had a kind of, she's got an entrepreneurial spark and a lot of great, like a skill set that really works for starting a business. And, you know, and she said, this is back in the mid 90s, she said, you know, this is a really good idea. I think we should do it. And I said, what do you mean we should do it? She said, okay, well, we should do it. Let's do this and let's do that and let's start. And so, you know, between us, we sort of, you know, talked ourselves into, like, you know, taking a running leap and flapping our wings really hard and seeing if it would fly. And so 20 years go by and here we are.
Well, that's good. That's good. And as my uncle would say, from this, you'll make a living. So, I mean, it's obviously an endeavor that you've built up an audience of 60,000 people. And, you know, you started thinking about this 35 years ago, you did this 20 years ago. And how has the medical profession changed or not changed over that period of 35 years?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would say it like you're putting it, it has and it has not. There's certainly greater tolerance for discussion about nutrition and things like the microbiome and the quote mind-body connection and, you know, psychoneuroimmunology, whatever you want to call it, all those kind of themes that were very, very alternative and really didn't get much play, especially within mainstream medicine back in the 70s and the 80s and even into the 90s when we started. Now you can talk about them and no one's going to like throw you out of the room. And even in very mainstream settings, they talk about probiotics and fish oils and you know, there's kind of a grudging acknowledgement that diet does play a role in disease. So in that sense, it has changed. There's certainly more discussion and a little bit more room at the table for those things. And it really hasn't. And I think the fundamentals that haven't changed are around how healthcare is financed. And I think that's the big obstacle, because we know that people want this kind of care. We know that. Anybody you talk to, anybody I tell about what we do, you know, what holistic primary care is about, they say, oh, yeah, I'm into this, or I really like that, or, you know, can you recommend a holistic doctor for me, or, you know, my mother or my wife or, you know, whoever. Somebody's looking for that kind of care. We know it, and we get calls very regularly from people who are seeking referrals for practitioners. So why can't people, I mean, if there were really free market forces, you know, you've got a demand and we know there's a lot of practitioners that want to practice that way. So why isn't the supply meeting the demand? And the reason is because we've got third party payers who aren't covering this. And unfortunately, most people economically are dependent on this insurance system for their health care. And the insurers have been very, very reluctant to get on board with this for, you know, fairly complex reasons, but they all have to do with money. And so for most people who want this kind of care, it's a straight up out of pocket expense, and it can be expensive. You know, let's get real here. If you're going to go to a functional medicine doc or a holistic doc, and you know, they do all the testing and then the supplements and all, it's a significant cost. And that's on top of what you're already paying in your premiums and your co-pays for your conventional care. So there's been an economic roadblock to the growth of the field. And then I think the other thing that hasn't changed is that fundamentally, and this gets into the whole COVID dialogue, fundamentally we're still, mainstream American medicine is still very much wedded to the view that diseases are caused by pathogens. And once you discover the pathogen and you blast the pathogen, you eradicate the disease. It goes back to that very old idea of, like, is it the terrain or is it the pathogen, which they started arguing about kind of at the dawn of microbiology, really, you know, in the 1800s. You know, Pasteur, and I think the other gentleman's name was Beauvais. And they had this debate, which is still going, about, like, what's the primary cause of an infectious disease? Is it the bug itself, or is it the fact that someone is susceptible to the bug, and then what leads to susceptibility? And overwhelmingly, in our medical culture, and I'm talking about, like, the deep-seated assumptions about how physicians and how we as people, as patients, view the world, we're wedded to this idea that it's all about the bug. And we give some lip service to individual susceptibility or environmental influences on susceptibility, but we really don't take that on in any systemic way. So even a lot of medical people who are holistically inclined, or, you know, they're open to using things like probiotics or supplements or vitamins, they're still kind of thinking them about it all in a very allopathic way. Not everybody, but I think generally speaking, the mainstream training is still very heavily focused on the pathogens and not giving a lot of attention to the terrain. And so that's where I think we get lost, honestly. And it's not one against the other. They're both, they're like two hands, you know, the two sides of a complete whole. And if we're not looking at both sides with equal attention, then we lose our way.
We know there seems to be a fundamental contradiction in between what we are learning now about the microbiome and the whole picture, and that we're part of this matrix and a system that is very reductionist, and a system that focuses on specialization and separation. And somebody's got to figure out that this top-heavy system that is the most expensive system in the world, where most of the money is really going toward profit. And people are profiting. If you want to look at the illness maintenance system, which is how I look at a lot of what mainstream medicine has become, as they've tried to address chronic conditions with the same kinds of ways they would deal with acute emergencies, a very high intervention, low prevention. Wouldn't it seem like insurance companies would be interested in prevention programs that would save tremendous amount of money down the line?
One would think. But it doesn't really work that way. I mean, if you talk to insurance people, they'll say, "Oh yeah, we have prevention. Sure, we pay for mammograms, and you know, we pay for vaccines and all that." That's how they define prevention.
Yeah,
they're
wow.
not. You know, they haven't really taken seriously the role of nutrition and even like fitness. People pay for their gym memberships and their yoga classes and all of that out of pocket. And yet it would save the insurance industry money if more people were doing that. But as long as I can get people to pay for that out of pocket, why should they pay for it out of their coffers? I think it's very, very important to understand, especially like when you're dealing with the for-profit insurance industry, that's what it is. Their primary responsibility is to their shareholders, and it's about sure, you know, it's about making profit. And whether you think that's right or wrong or good or bad, that's another debate. But that's the fact. And they obscure it, of course, with a lot of pretty language about care and about, you know, we're concerned for your health and well-being. And, well, you know, once, you know, the wellness word got, you know, became popular, they started using that too. And they all have these beautiful sounding names like WellCare. And, you know, it sounds very dreamy. But in actual fact, you know, look, they're trying to make money. And it's very interesting. We're going to be doing a program on June 12th where I'll be interviewing Wendell Potter. I don't know if you know him, but he's a very interesting guy. He used to be the head of communications for Cigna for many years. And mm-hmm. then he had a crisis of conscience, and he left that, and he's now a very outspoken critic of the insurance industry. He wrote a book about 10 years ago called Deadly Spin, which is about how the insurance industry manipulates public policy and how they derailed healthcare reform. And, you know, he kind of, like, takes you behind the curtain of the dark arts, you know, and it's a great book, and it's worth paying attention to him. And we're going to be talking about this, how, like, they're, like, during COVID, the insurers are making record profits because people are still paying their premiums, but most of the COVID care is not covered, and a lot of it because, you know, it's elderly people and it's poor people who are ending up in the hospital with COVID. That's going on Medicare, Medicaid, and all the other stuff that they normally would be paying for, people aren't going for those elective surgeries, and they're being postponed, and all these office visits that people used to go for, they're not going. So the insurers are making basically, excuse my language, but shit tons of money right now.
Wow. And it is so wonderfully, terribly paradoxical and sick. It's sick.
But that's what they're designed to do. And I think it's important whenever we talk about healthcare and healthcare policy to really understand that that's what they're designed to do. It's like the shark is designed to be a predator. And you can't fault the shark for being a predator. Now, you can say, well, I don't want my healthcare system built around predators, and that's a totally legit position. But the fact that they're behaving the way they're behaving shouldn't be a surprise. And when I say they, I mean the insurers. So, they don't want to spend on prevention because they don't see in the short term that they're going to save money. And by the time you don't have that heart attack in 20 years, they're not worried about you anymore because you may have to already change jobs and change plans a few times. You know,
they're not beholden to you. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll be back after these messages, back with Eric Goldman talking about our a true healthy and caring healthcare system. We can only dream. Steve Fairman, we'll be back shortly.
With the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
My name is Victor Fairman. Some call me The Voice. I've always been fascinated with human nature, spirituality, science, and the crossroads at which they meet. Join me Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern on Om Times Radio, and we'll explore these topics and so much more on Destination Unlimited.
Distancing tip.
While the CDC urges you to avoid close contact, like hugging or shaking hands, there are other non-physical ways to say hello. Wave, wink, use sign language, salute, smile, give the peace sign, throw up an air high five, do jazz hands. Remember, stay a minimum of 6 feet or 2 arms length away from others, and stay home if you can. For more info, visit coronavirus.gov.
Let's all do our part, because we're all hashtag alone together. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Well, hi, Steve Bettman. We're back with Eric Goldman. We're talking about health care. Actually, it seems to be a wealth care system that we have that's caring very well for the wealthy. And now with the current COVID-19 crisis, it seems as if the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, mainstream media, and social media are fighting a war on holistic practices of practitioners. They're deplatforming things, and including vitamin C. What do you make of that, and what can we do about it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't have a simple answer. It's like, yes, on the one hand, you can argue that they're deplatforming things, but the ability for people to share information now is absolutely unprecedented. And so it's kind of, you know, when we're looking at the internet per se, even as it is being mediated by these big platforms, it is still extraordinary how we're able to access information. I mean, I started my career at a time where if you weren't a physician or a nurse or a medical professional or like a professional medical journalist, you didn't get access to medical journals. Like you just didn't. I mean, now anybody with a computer or a smartphone can go on PubMed and can search the medical literature. And the volume of information that's come out, like the virology research that's come out in the last 4 months since this COVID thing broke, it's truly unbelievable. And I'm thinking back to the earlier part of my career during the AIDS epidemic, where it took them 10 years to figure out a lot of the basic things about how that virus worked and what it did and how it affected the body and where the potential targets were. And assuming you do believe that there is a COVID, you know, there is a coronavirus and it causes human disease, I realize that there's some people who question the entire thing. I don't. I believe there is a virus, and I believe it can be lethal. And the researchers figured out what this thing does and how it works and where the potential therapeutic targets are pretty darn quickly. And as far as the thing like the vitamin C, okay, so you could say they're suppressing that information, but we're finding out about things that people tried in hospitals. You know, IV vitamin C, for example, where ordinary citizens are finding out about this nonetheless through the internet. So, you know, it's like on one hand, it's suppressing information. It's not a totally free flow of information, but it's also way more accessible information than it ever was. So I think it is important to kind of put it into the broader perspective that, you know, the average citizen with a computer now has way more access to way more medical information than anybody ever did in the past.
That's a good point. Said, that's a really good point.
Yeah, it's important to not lose the baby with the bathwater. Now, first of all, I think on the ground, you know, people talk about this, you know, the conventional narrative and the conventional treatment path and all that, as if it's monolithic. And from what I understand, and again, I don't know a lot of what's going on in the hospitals per se. I don't deal with a lot of hospitalists or critical care doctors. But my sense is that different places are doing things very differently. And so there's not this like kind of monolithic marching orders and everybody's doing the same thing. I think they're trying to figure it out and they're overwhelmed. The tolerance for trying things that are outside of the drug scope is, I think, also very variable from institution to institution. Some institutions like don't permit a lot of variants. Some institutions permit a little bit more. I know there is a group, I can't think of the name of it offhand, but it's a group of American critical care, you know, like pulmonologists who are advocating for a protocol that includes IV vitamin C, high dose IV vitamin C, in the hospitals here. I think it's, you know, if you give me a minute, I can look it up, but I don't remember offhand what they call their protocol. But it's got vitamin C is one of them, and it's a combination of that and some pharmaceuticals. Mm-hmm. But they claim that if this was more widely used, it would save more lives. Now, you know, that's one question. Then there's the question of how much vitamin C should regular people be taking as prevention. And, you know, it's a great question for research. The reality is we don't know. It seems like a pretty good insurance policy, so to speak. You know, I hate to use that analogy, but like, mm-hmm. yeah, why yeah. not? You know, take you know, take a little extra vitamin C. It's really not going to hurt anybody unless you're, you know, seriously mega dosing. So, you know, yeah, I think there are things that merit research. Again, what I think, like, where the WHO has and CDC, you know, where they've dropped the ball is to not give any focus to, you know, vitamin C, vitamin D, some of these other things that they may not be definitively proven as therapeutic or as prophylactic against this particular coronavirus. There's enough precedent with other viral infections to say, yeah, you know, this kind of makes sense. There's no harm in doing it. You know what I mean? Like no one's going to die from taking vitamin D. So why not? Why not advocate that as a broad public health measure along with the masks and all that? And I feel like they don't do that partly because they just, you know, is it like a big conspiracy of the drug companies? I don't know. Could be. But it's more likely, I think, this myopia having to do with like what we talked about earlier before the break, where they're focused on the bugs and how do they blast the bugs. They're not focused on how do they support people's immune systems. That's just not part of the way they think.
It's the way that medicine is taught. And you know, obviously in our lifetimes, there's been far more influence ever since drug companies began to be able to advertise. And there's been far, far more influence of physicians by drug companies. I mean, that seems to be the main thing. And they're, you know, here in California, and I'm sure it's true in other states as well, you know, part of a physician's licensing has to do with how much he follows the drug protocols. And if, you know, if he or she is not prescribing enough drugs, then that kind of calls their practice into question.
You know, again, that's at the level of the insurers where they've got these utilization reviews and they're kind of tracking to what extent are physicians adhering to, quote, standards of care, which are usually drug-based. And if a doctor or nurse, for that matter, is not, quote, adhering to standards of care, then they're penalized. The use of pharmaceuticals as the mainstay treatment approach is sort of baked into how healthcare is financed, like what they get paid for, whether they're perceived as a, quote, good doctor or a problem doctor. It's all got to do with that.
So it sounds like there's two factors that are really at work that are, you know, rather than saying it's some kind of great conspiracy, on one hand, the money model makes it obviously pharmaceutical companies want to make money. Insurance companies want to avoid making payments. The managed care systems want to, we'll talk a little bit more about that, want to keep doctors as employees and continuous for-profit endeavors. And at the same time, there is this, the way that the education process takes place, which is much more that Newtonian medicine, forces and equal and opposite forces, rather than looking at the whole field, which is a new field of medicine. Those two factors seem to be really keeping the old system in place. And my question is, how can you know, the physicians that you're beginning to talk to, physicians, I'm sure that there are new people who get your newsletter every month, many of them physicians. How do you introduce this idea of the microbiome, which is so, in a way, so different from the kinds of, you know, shoot and kill kind of medicine that the medical profession is used to? How do you create that? How do you create a bridge between those two and deal with the contradiction?
Well, you know, that's an interesting thing, the microbiome. And it's, you know, we do a survey every year of our practitioner community, and we try and learn a lot about, you know, how they perceive different things and what they're using in their practices. And there's usually a suite of questions about their use of supplement products. And probiotics is consistently among the top three categories of supplement products that these practitioners are recommending, or in some cases dispensing in their offices. You know, we started writing about it not too long after we started the magazine 20 years ago, I would say, like, you know, we started writing about the microbiome and this whole probiotics thing. Around 2002, 2003, 2004, and I think the beauty of the microbiome as a story is that it appeals to a basic sense of wonder. You know what I mean? And it's also very factual. Like, it's just a simple fact. There's bugs in our digestive systems, and they're metabolically active, and they do things. And it's within the realm of the biology that people – medical people learned in high school and college and medical school. You know, it's not coming from outside. We're not talking about chi. We're not talking about, you know, things that come from outside the system. It's just like a biological fact. And it has this kind of almost like National Geographic, you know, like it takes people back to that sense of, wow, you know, the world is a wonderful and mysterious place. And it was sort of non-threatening in a way. It wasn't saying don't use drugs. It wasn't saying, you know, medicine is evil and vaccines are evil and all that. So it just kind of had this sort of benign quality about it. Like, oh, isn't that interesting? We have these bugs and some of them are helpful and some of them are harmful. And if you amplify or sort of facilitate the colonization with these helpful bugs, you sort of improve health. Somehow it seemed like a very non-threatening approach. But the problem was that, you know, like there were all these products came on the market and people started kind of using them in a kind of wanton way, both the public and even within medicine. And over time, you know, 10 years later, 15 years later, there started to be the question of like, is this really the right way to use them? How do we use them? Which kind of strains? As we learn more about the microbiome, the ability to use them intelligently will become more nuanced. And I think that really is holistic. It's not. I don't like the oppositional dyad of like alternative versus conventional and you know, allopathy versus everything else. It's like there are tools, both you know, therapeutic tools and intellectual tools, and they do different things. And to understand what the strengths and drawbacks are of each tool, it allows for better, more skillful use of all of them. But it does get hairy when it comes down to the economics, because there it is competitive.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, and I want to say about the microbiome. So there's a whole emerging story. We just posted a very nice piece about this from two young writers, Anita Teresa Benninger and Val Elefante. It's called The Virome, 10 Things You Didn't Know About Viruses. And so it turns out there's this virome. And if you think the microbiome is big and weird, wait till you read about the virome. I mean, the number of viruses that we know about as pathogens is so minute compared to the numbers of viruses that there are. And most of them are either harmful, some of them may be potentially beneficial. So in 10 years' time, we may find that we're talking about the virome in a very different way. Like we'll talk about, like, you know, provirotics. I don't know where that's going to go, but it's opening up, you know, and the COVID thing is opening up a whole wide field of virology. So, you know, all this is in flux. I just fundamentally believe in the research process, even with all its corruptions and all its manipulations by moneyed interests and whatnot. Still, I think human curiosity and creativity leads to interesting and potentially helpful discoveries.
No, that's really a helpful way to look at this, because again, you know, the people who are on the ground, so to speak, the people who are doing the care and the people doing the research, generally, these are all very well-meaning people who want to see health for everybody, and they want their work to be useful. And yet, because of the corrupting influence of that particular aspect of the system, not only has it created this you know, tremendous economic cost and disparity in the quality of care, but it's also created what some would call, you could either call it paranoia or realism, depending on your view. But those who are paying attention are concerned about a new level of what I would call medical totalitarianism in the wake of COVID-19, where vaccinations will become mandatory. I mean, not just the COVID vaccinations, but there's all sorts of other ones that may or may not be advisable. And so this feels like it's marginalizing many of the alternatives, just like genetically modified crops and chemical farming in a certain regard tends to marginalize organic farming because of the pollution of the organic farms by these other farms. So what's your take on all of that? I'm sure you see all kinds of points of view in your community.
Yeah, I do. And that's very complicated. That's going to be a long answer. Before I jump into that, I just want to say something about, you were talking about the medical personnel on the front lines and the intentions of them. And, so a couple of things right there. Medical people have been warning us for a really long time that our hospitals are in dire shape, that things are running in a very precarious way, that medical staff, particularly nursing staff, are underpaid, overworked, and at very great risk. The burnout level is really high. The physician suicide level is really high. And there's a film coming out about that. I think it's called Do No Harm. Watch for that in a couple of weeks or months. It's coming out this summer, I think. And they've been sounding the alarm for so long. And so part of the crisis, and I don't hear enough talk about this from any of our political sectors, part of the crisis here is that we're doing the social distancing and flattening the curve because we don't have a healthcare system that can handle a large public health challenge. And we ought to. I mean, we're, so to speak, first world, you know, top economy, best healthcare in the world, you know, wealthiest country. Come on. You know, I was really shocked when I saw those pictures of like medical personnel in my city in a hospital wearing hefty bags as personal protective equipment. I mean, that's an outrage. You know, that's an outrage. Other countries are doing a much, much better job of this. And so while we're talking about health freedom and all these kind of things and should we or shouldn't be wearing masks, bottom line is we should be taking much, much better care of the people that work in healthcare. But I want to say this, this is important. We have this very strange love of the martyrdom narrative, you know, and we love to call people heroes. Oh, our healthcare heroes and these selfless martyrs who are, you know, willing to run to the front lines. It's all this kind of military martyrdom language that we're using when we're talking about medical people. And it may make us feel good, but like I saw some posts from younger, you know, healthcare professionals, and they're like, listen, you know, I'm not a martyr, I'm not a hero, I'm trying to do a job. And I knew it was going to be a stressful job, but like I didn't sign up for military duty here. And so we love the narrative of the selfless martyr, but we're not taking care of them. We're not taking care of their families. And that's true across the board. We don't take care of our veterans very well. We don't take care of, you know, a lot of people who've been in the military, you know, police, fire departments. I was here down during 9/11, you know, like firefighters had to fight for basic medical care after they were exposed to all this burning stuff. So we love the medals and we love the ceremony and we love the salute, but as a society, are we taking care of the people who put their asses on the line? And I would say we need to do a much better job of that. Okay, so rant over.
Okay, before – oh, that's a good rant. That's a very good rant. We're going to take a little break, and you can continue to rant on the other side of the break, and we'll talk more about medical personnel and how their lives have changed over the last 40 years. This is Steve Bamman, and we're on WikiPolitiki.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
911, what is your emergency?
My kid shot himself.
All right, where's the wound?
911, what's your emergency?
Please help. My son shot his brother.
911, what is your emergency?
Okay. 911, please state your emergency.
Every day, 8 kids and teens are unintentionally killed or injured by loaded and unlocked guns.
It wasn't locked.
Learn how to make your home safer at endfamilyfire.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and End Family Fire.
Well, hi, this is Steve Behrman. We're back and we're talking about the sick care versus healing practice, which is a distinction our guest Eric Goldman came up with. We're talking about the people who are our doctors. And back in the day, I remember when I was a kid, our family practitioner made house calls. Remember those? And doctors were independent and self-sufficient professionals. And now they seem to be employees. How did that change? How did that transform into this servitude that we seem to have right now?
Yeah, that was managed care, I think, by and large. I apologize for that ringing. Let's see if I can turn that down. That was the managed care systems. And, you know what, let me just get rid of this. So I need to call you back. I think it started to happen around the 80s as managed care moved from being sort of a California thing, you know, the staff model, HMOs like Kaiser and all that. They moved east, so to speak. And by the mid 90s, they became the rule. And you had these PPOs and IPOs and or IPAs, I forget, yeah, independent practice associations, where the cost of managing a practice started to go up. And the hassle factor for getting reimbursed by insurance started to become greater. So a lot of the doctors felt like, well, you know, this is, you know, the administrative pieces are way too much right now. So it's easier for me to just sell the practice to a larger network, become an employee, get a paycheck, and not have to worry about all this administrative stuff. The reality is, and I saw this figure, this is a little outdated, it's probably about 6-7 years old, but the average primary care practice had 2.6, so almost 3 non-clinical staff people on payroll for every clinical staff. And that's just, you know, haggling with the insurance companies, arguing to get paid, managing all the claims. I mean, you've seen the coding system. It's 17 and it's so complicated. And so that's just cost that the insurance industry has offloaded into doctor's offices, and it's burdensome. And when you've got younger doctors who are still trying to pay off their loans for their education, which has gotten very, you know, insanely expensive, and they're starting a lot of their lives and trying to have a family and trying to buy a house and all the things that people do. And on top of it, their costs of just staying in business are going up. They face this kind of economic crunch where just for most of them, it made sense to sell the practice and take a paycheck. And, you know, it's a devil's bargain because in some ways it makes life easier and they've got more predictable hours until they don't. But the promise was like, yeah, you're not going to have to be slaving away all night. You don't have to make the house calls. It's going to take a lot of the hassle factor out of being a doctor. But it certainly was a devil's bargain, and they lost a lot of the independence that they had. But that's true. You see that consolidation all through the economy. I mean, it got harder and harder for small retailers. That's why, look at the health food store scenario, where, you know, back in the same time there was those doctors making house calls, there was local health food stores. And they were, you know, if there was a health food store in your town, it was independent. And then Whole Foods came along and the bigger, you know, conglomerates, and they started buying them up. And then so suddenly there's far fewer. And you see that all across the board in every retail sector you look at. It's hard for the little guys. We love, again, this is another mythology that America is very fond of, this mythology of the independent entrepreneur. But the reality is, like, the economy as it is has, like, killed a lot of that stuff. And it's much, much harder now, I think, to be an independent. It's easier. It's, in a way, it's easier to start. It's easier to start, and the internet tools make it easier to kind of market in a certain way and get your name out there, sort of. But to grow to the point where you can actually build a really strong, sustainable business, like a legacy business that you would pass on to your kids like people did in the olden days, I think that's way, way harder. You know, the business trajectory now is you build something small, you get it to a certain point, you take on capital to get it to a certain point where you sell it, you get your exit strategy, and then that's that whatever you started is owned by a bigger corporation. Anyway, you know, that's a tangent way of explaining what I think has happened in medicine as well.
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is a pattern, and it's a pattern that's based on, as we discussed earlier, it's based on the idea that money is the ruler, and we've kind of given into this. And, you know, as we're dealing with this crisis, we're, you know, perhaps if we had been better medically prepared, if we had been put our resources in other places and were prepared, you know, the economic detriment of this lockdown, we wouldn't be experiencing it because we wouldn't have had to, we wouldn't have been looking at flattening the curve. Perhaps we'd be looking at how we get herd immunity, and perhaps we would have been willing to look at the statistics that say that, you know, many, many, many people get the infection and few people get the very severe symptoms. So, you know, you make a good point about our lack of preparedness in that regard. One of the things that I've been working with for a number of years is the idea of the great uprising, that people are waking up to these contradictions in the system, that noticing unworkability, and, you know, every crisis that we have exposes the unworkability, you know, even with the you know, with the riots going on right now in New York and other towns. And then the so-called president that we have in charge, you know, it's simply it exacerbates everything. It brings out all of the toxicity. So in that kind of context, you know, what are the encouraging signs that you see that more people will begin to focus on these much less expensive modes of medicine? And demand that. Apparently, 1/3 of the people in this country or more use some form of alternative or complementary medicine, and something like 80% of people, buy organic food, and 50% buy organic food most of the time. So, what can we do? How do you see this this movement and understanding to broaden the medicine that we practice to make it more effective and more efficient? How do you see that moving forward? Are there any encouraging signs for you?
Yeah. There's two general directions. I mean, I'm thinking on the fly here. I mean, one is to try and engage the insurance industry and try and get them to cover more stuff. And I mean, I think the demonstration projects that have been going on within the Cleveland Clinic at their their Center for Functional Medicine, those are going to be important to watch, because they're essentially trying to, it's a proof of concept thing. Like, can functional medicine save money for a large, major name brand healthcare system? They're one of the largest in the world, and they're a destination system. So, you know, I think things like that, the Samuelis, you know, Susan and Henry, Sam, I think his name's Henry, they invested huge, I think, $200 million of their own money in building a new, entirely new, basically medical school at UC Irvine that's from the ground up going to train people in a more holistic, more kind of functional, integrative mode. You know, so I do think there are promising signs from within. I know Mayo Clinic has also, because I guess it's kind of a monkey see, monkey do with Cleveland Clinic. It's like, if Cleveland's going to be proactive on this, we better be proactive as well. And they hired our friend Adam Perlman, to open up a whole campus down on in Florida, sort of an integrative center at Mayo down in Florida. And he was, mm-hmm. he was responsible for the integrative clinic at Duke. So there are these movements, but they're slow. So I think like some push from trying to change the system within is going to be important. And then the other thing is, I think really until we as Americans are really willing to challenge, and I mean challenge, the complete lockhold dominance that the insurance industry has had on the financing of healthcare, we're always going to be stuck. I mean, I think that's where fundamentally it's where it's stuck. And do I think mm-hmm. it's a good idea for insurers to cover more integrative stuff? I don't know. It's kind of a mixed thing because we see what they've done with conventional care. Why do we think it's going to be any better with holistic care? But at the same time, it could make it more accessible. So, I don't know, because the reality is a lot of regular people, ordinary working people can't afford functional medicine as it is now. They just can't. They don't have the resources. And I know there are some doctors who are pioneering models, group visit models, and just like lower cost models to try and make it accessible. And I really applaud that. I think that's a really important piece of the equation. I think there are promising signs, but personally, having done this journalism / advocacy work for 20 years, it is a bit frustrating that we're still having the same discussions and we're still arguing about plant-based diets and, should we be taking vitamin C or not? Like, really? Are we still talking about this? Let's talk with the plant-based diet for a second, stuff there. Going back to COVID, so one thing that nobody really, really, really wants to talk about, I mean, some people are, but in the mainstream dialogue about this is the fact that, whether or not this virus was or was not zoonotic, the reality is a lot of infections are, and a lot mm-hmm. of the antibiotic resistance issue is because of antibiotic use in animal agriculture, i.e. meat and dairy and all that stuff. And the hard truth, and I'm not a total vegetarian, I'm getting pretty close, but the reality is if we ate less meat, there'd be less zoonotic infections. It's plain and simple.
Well, certainly if we ate less meat that was produced in factory farms. I mean, certainly that aspect of farming is totally horrific and disease creating. There's other arguments for more integrated farming that uses animals, but you're right. It's really, given the fact that this virus is pointing toward animals, I think perhaps more people might become aware of that. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah. Yeah. And I do, I want to go back to your question about the medical totalitarianism. I know we're running close on time, but is it a concern? Yes, I'm concerned about it. I'm concerned about totalitarianism in general and authoritarianism. And as we see, that playing out, day by day in the news, it is very troubling. The issue of mandatory vaccines, my sense is whenever you have an argument that generates a lot of noise and a lot of fervor, but does not lead to clear solutions, I tend to think that the argument isn't about what the argument pretends to be about. So with vaccines, my sense, and people may hate me for this, but I don't think the argument about vaccines is entirely about vaccines. It partly is about vaccines, but I think the bigger subtext argument is about to what extent does any state, any government, right or left, have the right to impose, you could say, certain behaviors and certain obligations on individuals for the greater, quote, greater good, and who gets to define mm-hmm. the greater good. And I feel like that's what the battle about vaccines is really getting into. And it's the same, it's interesting how the mask, the mask wars became a thing. On face value, mm-hmm. it's a simple and relatively painless public health recommendation. You're going to be out in public in large groups, or you live in a big city or whatever, wear a mask. That doesn't seem like a huge imposition to me, but some people made it about this sort of health freedom thing, and this is the first stage towards this totalitarianism of which you're speaking. And I'm like, yeah, I sort of see the argument, and I'm not certain I want to be forced to get a COVID vaccine because, you know, it's like any intervention, there's going to be downsides. You know, no intervention, you know, even echinacea, some people react to it. I don't happen to react very well with echinacea. You know, if I was forced to take echinacea, I wouldn't like that either. There's reasons to ask the questions. And I think, like, the question about autism, I don't think it's an either or. I think, you know, most kids are probably fine with vaccines. They get them. They don't become autistic. Some kids probably do, you know. And to make it a categorical either or, and to categorically dismiss it, or to categorically say that vaccines are a major cause of autism, I think both of those don't lead to clarity. The reality is, like, we know there's a lot of biodiversity from individual to individual, and it may be that there are some people who are really, really sensitive and very reactive immunologically. And so rather than saying, you know, vaccines are evil or vaccines are the savior, because I think there's that savior. You know, if I hear another politician to say, like, whoa, when we get a vaccine, or until we get a vaccine, it's a show, you know.
Well, we're about out of time. I really appreciate that nuance here, and recognizing that often the arguments are about something else. They're, you know, ideological arguments about some other principle. I really enjoyed our conversation, Eric Goldman. He is the editor of Holistic Primary Care News for Health and Healing. If you go to our website, WikiPolitik, you'll find a link to that. I want to thank you for being with us, Eric, and talking about holistic primary care and hopefully helping to move this movement along. This is Steve Behrman at WikiPolitik. We'll be back next week.